I do want to say before we leave that last segment that Angela Joyner, what a delightful woman. What a professional person she is, a professional journalist. I hope you liked her as much as I did. And I want to thank her again for coming on. I know some of that stuff is difficult to talk about, how you lost your job, that kind of stuff. No one wants to get into that, but she seems to be handling it pretty well. And as she admits, she's got the bug. Also, thanks to Alejandro Rojas from MUFON. Now, of course, longtime listeners of this program know the name Jim Mars. He's an award-winning journalist, a celebrated author. He worked for more than 30 years, I think, with several Texas newspapers. He's taught a course in UFOs at the university level. He investigated the U.S. Army's remote viewing program a few years before it was ever acknowledged by the CIA. Out of that came a book called Alien Agenda. I just reread it. It chills you to the bone, getting into not only UFOs but remote viewing and how those two things sort of cross paths. He's authored other books, of course. I've got this dog-eared copy of Crossfire, The Plot That Killed Kennedy, written years ago and was the basis for Oliver Stone's famous movie JFK. Jim Mars written a lot of other stuff as well. Most recently, a book called The Terror Conspiracy about the 911 case, and his most recent book, Psy Spies. Jim, you there?
Hello, George.
Hey, you know what? We've been this has been a long time coming. You and I have sort of traveled down the same path in a lot of ways, and we've talked before but never had a chance for an interview, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Right, and I'm glad you had Miss Joyner on there. I just want to tell everybody I honor her and I feel for her because, George, you and I have both been down that road, hadn't we?
Certainly have. Now, you're a Texan. You live in Texas now. You've worked for Texas newspapers. What is your take on that whole Texas story?
Well, I'll tell you, here's the most amazing thing about the Stephenville sightings. It's not that they saw a UFO. People have been seeing UFOs all throughout history, as anyone who's looked into the subject knows. The most amazing thing was that the Air Force, who initially said we did not have any planes in the area, after 2 weeks of these witnesses coming forward and news stories of propagating and growing across the country, they suddenly back up and say, oh, we made a mistake. Let's set the record straight. We had 10 F-16s up there. Now, the amazing part is not that, because the Air Force always has some kind of explanation. It's misidentified Venus, misidentified satellite.
It's swamp gas.
Yeah, swamp gas. It's crash dummies, okay? But the amazing thing about this, George, was that the bulk of the people, and certainly the people down here around where I live in north central Texas, and amazingly enough, some of the mainstream media were not buying it this time. In the Dallas Morning News, which is one of the most arch-conservative newspapers in the country, there was an item on their opinion page. They said, why is the Air Force backing up? You know, why are they changing their stories? There's something fishy going on here. What is it they don't want us to know? Now, isn't that amazing? After all these years, the media is finally beginning to try to feel a little bit of backbone and question these facile explanations that they always throw out to keep everybody bamboozled, distracted, and hey, folks, quit looking at this issue.
You know, you heard Angela, as I did, say that, well, the military didn't really say it's the F-16s that you saw out there as an explanation for those craft. But, I mean, it certainly has the effect of trying to throw some cold water on it, doesn't it?
Well, they certainly left that inference, didn't they?
Yeah, sure did.
And by the way, as a former military aviation aerospace writer, let me just point out, people in the military will understand what I'm saying. Short of World War III, you're not going to have 10 F-16s flying around in one area.
That's a heck of an exercise, I guess.
That's right. And then when they asked them what the exercise was, whoever was speaking for the Air Force said, well, we really don't know. We weren't in communication with them.
Tell me this.
What?
Yeah. Tell me this, Jim. I mean, you must get this kind of criticism a lot over the years, the kinds of subjects you've covered in your books. That you must be an evil man who hates America if you want to publicize this stuff. For example, a lot of folks suggest that whatever's flying around out there over the skies of Stephenville and that area must be some highly classified project, and we shouldn't even be talking about it.
Well, you know, if I was satisfied that that's exactly what it was, some secret government test craft, I myself might be a little hesitant to talk about that. I served in the U.S. Army and with military intelligence, and I had a top secret security clearance. And I know perfectly well that there are times and there are subjects where it might serve the national interest just, you know, not to go there. But this is not one of them. For one thing, how about if I could show you that there were sightings in Stephenville prior to anything man-made in the air?
Oh,
I can. I'm looking here at the Dallas Morning News for April the 19th, 1897. And the very first lead story is headlined, The Great Aerial Wanderer, and it's dateline, Stephenville, Texas. And they're talking about a large silver cigar-shaped object that they saw flying through the skies and that landed and that talked to them and told them that it was a secret experiment from New York. But don't say anything about this. And, of course, they immediately ran to the newspaper and said, hey, look what we saw. And this was in 1897. This is 6 years before the Wright brothers flew. So I'm sorry, the old secret military test craft just certainly won't hold up in that instance. And I don't think it holds up in the current sightings that are going on around Stephenville.
That's the great airship flap of 1897 then,
right? That's exactly right. It was seen by thousands of people across the United States, started in Sacramento, California, and the fall of 1896, moved up to Seattle, moved across to Chicago. By 1897, it was coming down through the Midwest. And by April of 1897, it was seen in southern Oklahoma, north Texas, going at speeds greater than 150 miles an hour. And, of course, George, today that doesn't sound like much, but when I read the old microfilm and was studying that time period, there was a train they were getting ready to put into service in the Northeast that they said might reach speeds of 40 miles an hour. And there were some prominent scientists and physicians who were saying that, you know, the human body cannot withstand speeds of greater than 40 miles an hour. So for somebody back then to say that it was going about 150 miles an hour, that it was going faster than anything they could imagine.
All right, Jim Mars, stick around. When we come back, we got a lot of stuff to cover. When we come back, we're going to jump right into Psi Spies. Stay with us, everyone. A lot more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, everyone. We're speaking with celebrated author Jim Mars. Jim, I'm reading the rundown, the schedule of events for the International UFO Congress to be held starting Friday, February 22nd, in beautiful Laughlin, south of Las Vegas here. And among the speakers is one Jim Mars, who it says you're speaking about Psi Spies, and then it says you're going to bring the audience up to date on conspiracy theories, including the greatest conspiracies prevalent today. It sounds to me like they didn't know what the heck you're going to talk about.
Well, I'm still wondering about that myself.
What are you going to talk about?
I think, and this may be worth making the trip out to Laughlin. I have spoken before, of course, on remote viewing. There's a lot of people, including most of the military trained remote viewers who are out there describing their experience. But I think that what I'm going to do is when I wrote my book about remote viewing, I actually, several years ago, commissioned a remote viewing study of ETs, aliens, UFOs, and I put some of that material in my book, Alien Agenda, which I believe you've read, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay. But, obviously you can't put everything in there. You're a print journalist like myself, and that's one reason I turned to writing books is because, no matter how much space they give you, it's never quite enough to get everything you know in there.
You should try it on television.
Right. You got about 15 seconds. So what I'm going to do is I think I'm going to discuss remote viewing UFOs and just concentrate because most people who are interested now know the story of the military remote viewing and the accomplishments that they made. So I'm going to just concentrate on what happened when they took a look at UFOs and other things. For example, and I'll just leave you with this teaser, when several of the military remote viewers encountered these things flying around and began to realize that this was a reality and that they were had to be coming from somewhere and going somewhere, and then they began to wonder, is there a central authority? So they actually tasked one of the best viewers to go take a look at what they could only describe as Galactic Federation headquarters, okay? And, of course, I'm sure that's not the name of it, but you get the idea. And sure enough, he ended up in this very strange place, and I'll just describe some of the things that they came up with. Back in the 90s when I was dealing with this, if you talked about UFOs, you know, everybody would snicker at you at best and run from you at worst. And so some of this stuff was so bizarre that I knew that nobody was really going to pay much attention to it. But I think we've had a tremendous consciousness raising taking place since the 90s. Would you agree, George?
Oh, absolutely. And especially when it comes to remote viewing. I mean, you know, there are those, the official, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but the official view is, well, it's been debunked. It's not useful. You know from your research that our government knows this is a useful tool and is real, right?
Of course. Why else would they have continued to fund it through four separate administrations, both Democratic and Republican? And let me tell you, the way they got their funding is really interesting. Early on, of course, they would hold a meeting and, I don't know, maybe have flip charts or whatever and try to give the scientific background, and their reception was, let's just say, cool. Because at that time, nobody, particularly in the military or in the intelligence community, really even wanted to believe that psychic ability was real. So, but what they finally evolved to was bringing in congressmen and military officers who would buy their product, who would pay the bills, and they get them to do it themselves. And after they said, then they go, holy cow, I did it. This really works. And they get their funding.
Have you tried it?
I have. I've even been tested on it. And apparently I'm pretty good, which doesn't surprise me because I had figured out years ago that the reason that I tended to be a pretty good reporter was because I had learned to trust my intuition.
You can tell when people are lying to you.
Exactly. And, you know, it's a combination of things. It's body language and it's tone and eye contact. And it's not. Now, I'm not going to say I can't be fooled. I have and I probably will. But I'm really pretty good at it. One experience I had was went over to Dallas to an office to do some testing for remote viewing. And I walked in this office, a very long rectangular office, and I never really got past about the first quarter of the office. Walked in, there was a desk there, and there was a table, and I sat down. And the very first coordinate number that I was given, I went through the protocols, and all I could see was this potted plant, you know? And then, so I opened my eyes and I'm saying, I think I've got a problem. And I looked at the far end of this office was a potted plant that looked very much like what I was seeing in my mind's eye. So I said, okay, let's start over. And so I followed the coordinates again and all I could see was this damn plant. So finally, after about three times, I said, hey, let's just stop this. I said, I don't know what's going on. I said, but all I keep seeing is that plant down there over in the corner over there, which I'd never gone to. And the person that was testing me said, well, what do you get about that plant? And I said, well, I get that it's not real. You know, it's some sort of artificial thing. And so he pulled out the envelope, opened up the object of my test, and guess what it was? It was the plant in the corner. And I walked down there, and not only had I seen that plant, and I had not noticed it when I came in the office, but I noticed it after I had seen it remote viewing, and then I felt of it, and of course it was plastic. It was not real.
You think everybody has some ability in that regard?
Yes. In fact, the testing that was done at Stanford Research Institute confirmed two amazing things. One, that everybody they tested, and that included trained and experienced military officers, all the way down to people almost that they just pulled in off the street. Everybody they tested has this ability to one degree or another. Of course, that's like saying you and I both have the ability to play Chopin on the piano.
Or dance. Or dance, for that matter.
Or dance, yeah. Yeah. But if you practiced enough and had a teacher and practiced and practiced and practiced, yes, you could. And yes, everybody could. And, of course, some people are better at it naturally than others, but what they found was everybody had the ability. And the other amazing thing they found was that it is, this ability is not limited by time or space. They have successfully remote viewed other planets, and then a decade later, when they sent out a space probe and they started getting the readings and the photographs back, the remote viewing was confirmed. And feedback, as they call it. And so it's just amazing. But
I tell you,
let me stress here, and I think you understand this, George, but for the sake of your audience, I just want you to understand that remote viewing is really not even the name of the function. The function is psychic function, which has been called clairvoyance. It's seeing with the mind's eye. The remote viewing actually describes the protocols, the techniques that they learned and devised in the military so that people could call up this ability on demand and self-interrogate themselves to the point of making it a useful source of information. And so what I'm trying to say is, if you think you can just sit down in a chair and see what's happening on Mars, it ain't going to happen. You really have to follow the strict protocols. You have to really work at it, practice, practice, practice. And so it's not a matter of buying a book or buying a tape and just doing it. Although in my book, SciSpies, I do offer a outline of the protocols and how a person could sit down, which is south of Fort Worth here in Texas, and they had a rash of these cat mutilations. And what I'm talking about is people will find half a cat, okay, and they can't find the hindquarters or they can't find the front quarters. And these people were in a community where they had a rash of these cat mutilations. And, George, it is a gated community, which means there's limited access and egress, which means, you know, you couldn't have just anybody and everybody rolling in there and killing the neighborhood cats and then rolling out of there. So this is a strange new wrinkle, and I'm not sure what to say about that, other than one of the theories is that they're sending a message probably to the government or the military saying, you know, you can't stop us. We can go anywhere and do anything.
You know, Linda Howe had written about that, I think, 5 or 6 years ago. There was an outbreak, a brief outbreak of that in Denver somewhere.
Right.
Somewhere in Colorado.
Oh, it happened at various places all across the country. And that's another thing, George. Some of your listeners may be under the impression, because the media is so controlled and they don't get to hear about this on any kind of regular basis, that these cattle mutilations, animal mutilations, that, well, that happened some years ago, but it's not happening now. No, it is happening now. It's still continuing.
Well, you know, you will have to wonder about the fear factor. I think I've heard Jacques Vallée talk about this, is that by leaving the bodies behind, by these gruesome mutilations, cutting a cat in half, that freaks people out. And
exactly.
I don't know what the aim is, but it certainly leaves an impression.
Well, you know, I tend to think that they're going back maybe into the 40s. If you go back and study your UFO history, you say you just finished Alien Agenda, so you'll know what I'm talking about. Early on, when it became clear to the military that this was something real, they actually issued orders for military units to shoot down UFOs. You know, if you see them, shoot them. And that really didn't last very long, because I forget the exact year, but about 1952, 53, somewhere in there, there was suddenly an incredible increase in the number of air crashes. I mean, planes seemed like they were just dropping out of the sky. And I don't know when or if or how some communication was made, but the military then stepped back, issued orders that they were not to shoot at UFOs. They were simply to try to track them and figure out what they were and where they were going. And right after that, this increase in air crashes stopped. So perhaps the cat mutilations is something else has come up. Maybe we've gone back to shooting at them or in somewhere interfering with them, and they are sending a message saying, look, you know, if we can drop into gated communities and other communities all across the country and leave a mutilated cat behind, you know, we could do this to people too. So cease and desist whatever it is you're doing.
You know, we didn't have a time to get into JFK too much, but of course that was the first book I ever read by you, Crossfire. It still bothers me, and all the grief that, you know, Oliver Stone took over that movie.
Right.
And all the grief that you have probably taken over the years, because
oh, yeah.
for the simple reason that people say, well, it's too darn many theories. It's the Mafia, it's the CIA, it's LBJ, it's the Cubans. Make up your mind. But for all of that, I mean, as you said, I don't know anybody who believes that Oswald acted alone. Not
no.
a person.
No, and here's the two things to remember always about the Kennedy assassination, because there's never been a cover-up in the classic sense of the word that you couldn't get information. The cover-up in this case has been obfuscation. They've thrown so much stuff out there and muddied the water so much that the average person just say, oh, man, I'm tired of hearing about that back and forth. Claim and counterclaim. But here's two things to absolutely remember about the Kennedy assassination. Number one, one person could not do the shooting, period. They've tried and tried. They've even had some TV programs trying to say, oh, well, we've shown that this could be done, but actually it can't. The FBI said the rifle that supposedly was used, 6.5 Mannlicher Carcano, they verified, and I verified this too, it takes 2 seconds just to cock the bolt and pull the trigger. And the shooting sequence, based on the Zapruder film, clearly shows that the shooting sequence took place within 6 seconds, 5.8 to be exact. Okay, so that's a 2/10 of a second under
the best time.
Best time you can do, just cranking the bolt and pulling the trigger. And that leaves no time for any kind of aiming, okay? And then the next thing you always have to remember is they're still talking about how Kennedy, the magic bullet, okay, the single bullet went through Kennedy's neck and struck Connally and caused all the wounds to Connally and then ended up in his left thigh. Kennedy was never shot through the neck, period. End of story. The autopsy clearly shows the holes in his shirt and his jacket clearly show. The witnesses clearly state he was shot at the level of the third thoracic vertebra, which is below your shoulder blade. So if he was shot below the shoulder blade in the back, how could the bullet, without hitting anything, course upwards and then exit out his throat? And if it did, then it would be going in an upward trajectory, and it would be physically impossible to hit Connally. Okay? And, of course, they've come out with all these convoluted theories. Oh, his jacket rode up. Oh, he was waving. Oh, he bent over. You know, and none of this is correct. The correct point is that the autopsy doctors tried to probe this back wound, and it didn't probe. It didn't go through his body. So he got hit in the back, and the bullet never came out anywhere.
I remember that scene in the movie, that the tracing the track. Was it back and to the left, the Kevin Costner scene with that?
That's the trajectory, yeah, and everybody can see that for themselves in the Zapruder film, which is, and this is sheer physics. This is for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. If you're hit in the front of the head with a baseball bat, your head does not fly forward. Your head flies backwards.
Jim
and,
Mars?
If he was struck from behind by a high-powered bullet, then his head would have immediately been thrust forward. But that's not the case. It's backwards to the left.
We got to take a break. We're going to open up the phone lines. When we come back, stick around at Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're talking about wheels in the sky and things that go bump in the night and all sorts of conspiracies with best-selling author Jim Mars, author of Alien Agenda, author of Crossfire, Psi Spies, and a whole bunch more. Jim, while we're waiting for calls to start in, I wanted to, before we leave the JFK thing, just want to tell you that one of the things that always stuck in my head, and it's in the movie, too, is the scene where this woman is driving in a car and she's thrown out on the side of the road. And I remember from your book, Crossfire, that she was a real person. person. There was a real witness who said, I was going to Dallas with these two guys. They said it was our mission to kill JFK, or they had something to do with the assassination plot. And she told this to police a couple days before JFK was killed, right?
Yes, her name was Rose Sherman. She also had worked for Jack Ruby, which ties him into the whole thing. And you're absolutely right. The House Select Committee on Assassinations actually did a whole little appendix on this woman, and they went and interviewed everybody at the hospitals there in Louisiana, the police, state police officials, and everybody involved. And she was trying to warn people that Kennedy was going to be killed in Dallas several days before it happened. Same thing, I interviewed a lawyer who had been in Jack Ruby's club and who saw a young man come in and sit in a booth with Jack Ruby several weeks before the assassination. And he was over there representing one of Ruby's clients. And he overheard the conversation, and it was, Lee, what are you doing back in town? I thought you were in New Orleans. And they went on and on about an assassination plot. And this attorney actually filed a report prior to the assassination placing Oswald and Ruby together. Talking about this conversation after the assassination, and they showed pictures of Lee Oswald, who had been in New Orleans, and he said that's the fellow that was talking to Jack Ruby. So we could spend a whole program talking about the instances of people who put Oswald and Ruby together. General Walker, Edwin Walker, once even told me that. And as Walker said, they're going to have to start all over just on the basis of the fact that Ruby and Oswald knew each other prior to the assassination.
We could also spend a whole program on all the people who died, all the people who are witnesses to one part of it or another who died, some of them from natural causes or supposedly natural causes, but a lot of them from causes that decidedly were not natural.
That's true. One important witness named Worrell was a biker, and they found him outside of Dallas with his motorcycle standing up on the kickstand, and he's lying beside it with his neck broken, and they ruled it a motorcycle accident. Picture this. He skids over. He breaks his neck. He gets up. He puts the motorcycle up on his kickstand, then he lays down and dies. Give me a break.
This is a personal interest sort of about Jack Ruby, but his Las Vegas connections. I've looked into some of those in the past, and Jack Ruby did have some. Did you come across any of those that you recall?
Oh, yes. Yes, very definitely. In fact, one of there was a very well-known, wealthy man in Fort Worth who owned the newspaper there, and he made frequent trips to Las Vegas. And he had hired a woman to be his daycare sitter for his young children. That was Marguerite Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald's mother. And just about 2 weeks or 3 weeks prior to the assassination, this man made a trip to Las Vegas, came back, and would not even talk to Marguerite Oswald, simply left her a note that said, "Your services are no longer required." And 2 weeks later, her son's charged with killing the president. There were a lot of people that knew what was going to go on.
Essentially, you believe that Oswald thought he was working for the government as an agent or something like that. Our government.
Well, that's what his mother always told me. She said, "My son is employed by the government." And, of course, again, we could spend a whole program talking about all of the connections between Lee Oswald and the government. I think the only thing to say there is that a very prominent and distinguished military historian, John Newman, has published a book called Oswald and the CIA. And in there, based on internal CIA message traffic, only made public after the Oliver Stone movie, he conclusively shows that the CIA was using Lee Harvey Oswald operationally prior to the assassination. And one of these days, the truth will come out, and we'll find that Osama bin Laden was being used by the CIA prior to 9/11.
We'll have you back on the show for that, a whole show for that. But have you heard of this guy in Canada who says he's JFK's love child, is asking for, in the pages of Canadian newspapers, asking for Kennedy DNA?
Who does he claim his mother is?
That I don't know. I'm sorry, I don't know that one.
Uh, I don't either. That's, you know, there's, again, keep in mind that the name of the game is obfuscation. Okay, you just throw so many theories and so many things like this out there that it just confuses the issue to the point to where hardly anybody wants to deal with it.
Are you familiar with Vincent Bugliosi's book on the assassination?
Oh, yes, yes. I just had to put that one down quickly because I got a Charlie horse in my arm. It's 1,700 pages. He should have changed the title. It should have been entitled Reclaiming the Warren Commission. George, just forget it, okay? It's nothing but the same old prosecutorial brief against Oswald with no consideration being given to the massive amount of information that could show his innocence or show that he was, as he himself said, was set up to be the patsy in the assassination. Bugliosi even devotes 2.5 pages to a made-up conversation between some imaginary mafia guy named Vito and Jack Ruby, which, you know, it, by his own admission, never took place. You know, how's that advance the case?
Okay, we're going to come back, take a short break, come back and take some viewer listener calls. So stick around. Jim Marsh, hanging in there?
I'm hanging.
All right, we'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. We have some time left with Jim Marsh, best-selling author, and we're going to go to the phones now. First to our East of the Rockies line, Jimmy in Brooklyn. What's on your mind?
Hi. JFK, President Kennedy, was constantly warning Martin Luther King about his communist advisors around him, and then JFK gets killed by a communist. Now, I know a lot of people don't want to believe that, but there's a common denominator between Martin Luther King and Lee Harvey Oswald. One of them is Carl Braden, who's the head of the Department of Agitation and Propaganda, because Lee Harvey Oswald was one of the heads of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and that's a communist-controlled group, and Martin Luther King attended the Highlander Folk School. Both of these groups had contact with Carl Braden, who was the head of the Department of Agitation and Propaganda.
Whoa, the Department of Agitation and Propaganda, where's that at?
That's for the U.S. Communist Party, Carl Braden.
Oh,
and he also got, Carl Braden got convicted in 1956, I believe it was, for blowing up a black home in Louisville, Kentucky. The Communist Party also trained Sam Bowers, the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, who was made famous because of the movie Mississippi Burning. The goal was to stir up race trouble in America, to discredit America in the eyes of Africa as the Soviets were making their moves on Africa.
Hey, Jimmy, do you have a question? Do you have a question for the guest?
Well, I just think the guest is helping promote the idea of world government and some of the stances he's taken, pushing the idea of global warming when that's already being debunked, because the people who are pushing global warming want global solutions, which means global government and global control, and I think that's pretty dangerous.
Okay. Jim?
Well, I think the caller needs to do a little bit more digging. He'll find out that Oswald himself said he was not a communist. He was a Marxist, and he was carefully schooled because he was trained to infiltrate communist activities. His activities in New Orleans was to try to draw out pro-Castro communists. He was working for the government. The whole thing was an early COINTELPRO, and I've never said there's no global warming, okay? But, by the way, just for the caller's benefit and for everybody's listening, the problem's not with your SUV. The problem is solar system-wide warming. The polar caps on Mars are melting. The outer planets are becoming more iridescent because they're heating up. The sun is erratic. This is something that whatever's going on, it's impacting the entire solar system, not just the Earth.
And I guess maybe, you know, if you want to debate whether humans are causing global warming on Earth, you could say that at worst or at best, we're not helping anything with it.
Well, obviously we have some problems with pollution and environmental degradation, but so I'm not saying that we should just keep rollicking merrily along and partying and destroying the Earth, The caller is right about the fact that this thing about global warming, and it's all because we're driving cars, that's just being used as a control mechanism.
And okay. All right. We're going to go to our first-time caller list, Carl in Ann Arbor, Michigan. What are you doing?
Good show, guys. Mr. Marsh, I've just got a couple of comments, and then I have a question for you. First of all, I think the whole key to this thing, if anybody knows anything about high-powered rifles and scopes, there's two words that'll prove to everybody that Oswald couldn't have done this by himself. The two words are moving target.
Absolutely.
Oswald was a sharpshooter with stationary targets in the Marines, not moving targets. That's how they train.
Wait, and let me interject quickly that he was they classified him as a marksman, which is the lowest of the three grades. It's marksman and then sharpshooter and then expert. And
exactly.
When he was about to get out of the Marines, he only qualified as marksman, the lowest grade by only 2 points. So he was a mediocre to poor shot.
Exactly. And me being involved with the SWAT team here in the Michigan area, I can tell you, when you shoot a high-powered rifle, you have to acquire your picture through a scope, and that's on a stationary target. After the rifle discharges, the recoil will throw your eyes off the target. You then have to reacquire. You have to rack the gun with a bolt-action rifle, then reacquire a sight picture for the second shot. On a moving target, it's nearly impossible to do within that time frame. He could not have done it. And the question I have for you is this.
Well, wait, let me ask you one thing, because you say you're a sniper with a SWAT team?
With a .308 rifle, exactly.
Okay, then I'm sure that you're aware of plunging fire, which means if you fire from a high position to a lower position, gravity has to be taken into consideration, because your bullet will drop lower, a little bit lower than where you're actually aiming. So you have to compensate not only for your windage, but also for this plunging fire. Isn't that correct?
Exactly. That's exactly right. But the bigger issue is a moving target.
That's the big one.
Now, he probably had the rifle rack for the first shot, so he didn't have to. He already had the sight picture acquired. But when he had to rack the rifle for the second shot, he lost his sight picture. He would have to reacquire a sight picture for the second shot through the scope on a moving target.
Right.
That is nearly impossible. It's not even considering the adrenaline that's going through him at the time, because he is shooting at the President of the United States.
Right.
It's impossible for him to make those three shots. The two key words are moving target. And the question I have for you is, why haven't more experts in scope rifle firepower come out and discuss this issue?
Well, they have, but they get short shift in the corporate-controlled media, which does not allow that information to be widely disseminated.
Thanks, Carl. That was excellent. We're going to go to our wild card line, Jeff in Chelsea. Jeff, are you there?
Yes. Very, very simple. I think that the UFO phenomenon, for the most part, is our military technology or some other technology, and I will preface it with two books. One is called Black Helicopters by Jim Keith, which Jim Keith believes in the same thing, that for the most part, the UFOs is just advanced military technology. And also a book called America at the Brink by Thomas Bearden, who is a lieutenant colonel in the Army, who talks about Russian scalar technology and the effect of Russian scalar technology can mimic UFOs.
Okay. Actually, I'm very well aware of Jim Keith and his material, the late Jim Keith. And I think that largely I agree with him. I've already said early in the program that I think many of the sightings we're having today are probably secret government test craft. The question, though, is where did they get that technology? And my question to you is, if it's all military, secret military test craft, how do you explain these massive UFO sightings prior to the Wright brothers flying?
Well, in the case of America, after and I know where you're coming from, but after World War II, you had Operation Paperclip, and there is a 10% wiggle room to which is debatable, because
wait a minute, what do you mean by wiggle room? We're talking about 1896 and 1897, when the newspapers were filled with stories of this balloon, cigar-shaped object flying at fantastic speeds across the countryside.
Well, demonic activity.
Demons. Okay.
That's the 10%, which is you do have about 10 to 15% wiggle room, and there is such a thing as demonic activity, which is described in the Bible. So So you do have
a new lottery number. Numbers cause a problem. Yeah, it's pretty funny. One of the remote viewers said he's always having people come up to him saying, well, hey, remote view, give me the winning lottery number. And he always says, well, you know, if I could do that, why would I give it to you?
Well, one of the, at least one of the realities, potential future realities that they looked at is something wherein humans are forced underground. Am I right?
Right.
In dome cities, something like that?
Right. And, you know, interestingly enough, I have gotten that same information from people who are not military-trained remote viewers, but, you know, say that they are natural psychics, that in the – I don't think this is going to be in the immediate future, but in the intermediate to far future, eventually, apparently, the atmosphere and the environment of the Earth is going to get so bad that in the far future, most – humans will be living under these domes to protect them from a somewhat harsh environment. That's why I think it might be incumbent upon us to start thinking seriously about, instead of like President Bush pulling us out of the Kyoto treaties, we might need to start backing up some of these treaties that are trying to be put into place to save our ravaged environment. And that's another thing I want to point out. When remote viewers look in the past, everything's pretty hard and fast, pretty clear. But as they look into the future, the further into the future they go, the hazier it is, which tells me it has not been firmly established or created, which means that we still have a bit of freedom of choice right now and that we could take steps today that could prevent some of these darker views of the future.
You know, in the first hour, you talked about some of the early remote viewers, advanced guys who came into contact with something the equivalent of a galactic federation,
mm-hmm.
and we'll talk about that in a moment, about different alien groups and different scenarios that they've encountered as they're in their mental or psychic journeys. I'm curious how it affects them as humans. And these guys who are, I mean, they're very much human. They live here. They have families.
Right.
They see these dark scenarios. It's got to be depressing for them, isn't it?
Well, it certainly, I would venture to say that every single military-trained remote viewer has had such a consciousness expansion that it changes them. They are not the same grounded people that they were before they went into this because, well, as Mel Riley was one of the earliest of the remote viewers, and, of course, he was always tasked to go look at Soviet submarines. And as he once told me, he said, but after you've gone out mentally and looked around at the universe, it's kind of tough to get excited about a Russian submarine.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard that quote. I guess the other question would be, explain to me sort of the hierarchy of aliens as you've learned it from the remote viewers. Do they have a pecking order, different races, and where do we fit into all that?
Well, yes, there apparently there are several different races of non-humans. Of course, we all know about the little small big-headed grays. We know that there is then a race of taller grays. There is the race that they call the Nordics because they seem to be very human-looking, but they're statuesque and they have blonde hair. Then you've got your reptilians, and then you've got some really weird guys that look like praying mantises and giant grasshoppers. Who knows? But the ones that intrigue me was what some of the remote viewers encountered that they call transcendentals. And they said these are just basically beings of energy and light. And, of course, the problem here is we carry within our own minds and hearts a whole lot of baggage that clouds our perception of what these people are and what we're actually seeing. For example, George, if you and I and another person are walking through the woods and a diminutive little green figure runs out in front of us and runs off into the woods, you're liable to say, well, I just saw an alien. The guy with us says, no, I saw a demon. And I'd say, hey, I saw a leprechaun. So, you know, we've got all this perception problem that we have, but there is a reality out there, and it's coming closer and closer. And that's something I'll share with you tonight, is that I have some pretty good information coming from a very good source that just recently, in fact, last week, that there was a meeting held at the United Nations, and that the decision has been made by someone up topside. I don't know if they call themselves MJ-12 or not, but you know what I'm talking about, the group that's in charge of the embargo of information about the reality of UFOs. And the decision has been made, or I should say made for them, because of events like Stephenville, the gate 17C at O'Hare Airport last November, and things like that, that they have decided that it is time that they start gradually releasing more and more credible information about the reality of UFOs and these non-human races that are out there.
Hold that thought. We need to take a break. When we come back, I want to find out how solid your information is. Stick around, everyone. We're talking to author Jim Mars. This is Coast to Coast AM. Back to Coast AM. Our guest is Jim Mars. Jim, you were talking about these remote viewers who had seen something early on about Galactic Federation. Help me understand that, meaning that there's some other force in the universe or galaxy that that is superior to us, that keeps an eye on us. I mean, how do we fit in with that? And as part of that question, on your 1 to 10 belief scale, 10 being strongest, how much do you believe this stuff?
Okay, well, they called it Galactic Federation Headquarters, which is just a tag that they hung on a search for a central administrative entity that may be in one way or another controlling, manipulating, ordering, I don't know, the various groups of non-humans. And where they went to was a very strange place, and I can only tell you that it, to me, appeared to be more spiritual in nature than it was some place like you'd see in Star Wars with spiraling, gleaming spires and little things flitting through the air all over the place. And my impression is that these races, although they have evolved some very advanced technology, the more advanced technology you have, of course, obviously, you're going to also grow in spiritual and social knowledge. And this may well be why they are quarantining the Earth at the moment, because, let's face it, the modern UFO era really got cranked up right after we started setting off nuclear bombs. And I've always used the analogy, somewhere up there somebody said, get the car, Frank. The kids have found the matches. And so I think that that perturbed them, because when you set off a nuclear explosion, you are not only impacting the environment here, but that's sending pulses, waves, radiation, ripples all the way through the energy field that makes up our universe. So they wanted to know, is there a central place? And it took them to this essentially a ziggurat or a pyramid near a lake, and where there were cloaked figures. And it was very reminiscent. See, I have visited in Tibet, and this, as it was described to me, it sounds very, very similar to a scene that you might find high in the Himalayas.
And course,
go ahead.
On a scale of 1 to 10, are you buying this?
Well, considering that the people who participated in this look have good track records, they have been honorably discharged from the United States Army, and that on so many things where they did get feedback, they have proven to be correct. I would say on a scale of 1 to 10, I'd give it a pretty high 6, 7, somewhere up there.
Is Lynn Buchanan one of the guys who is seeing this stuff?
Yes, he is. And Lynn is a very thoughtful and insightful man. And that's another thing. Lynn is teaching remote viewing at the moment from his home there in New Mexico, and as is so many others of these former SciSpies, which tells me that obviously they feel like that they're onto something very genuine and very real here, or they wouldn't have, you know. I can understand while they're in the military and they're ordered to do this and their paycheck comes because they're doing this, well, they'd continue to do it. But once they're out there on their own, you would think that if it was all bourgeois, that they would drop it, but they haven't. They have all continued one way or another. Some are working with institutions, some are writing books, some are teaching courses, and they're all continuing their work with remote viewing.
Were you, you said earlier that you had tried this yourself. Did you continue the studies? And if so, did you ever try that to find the Federation headquarters yourself?
No, I'm not that good. I guess I'll have to tell on myself here. I kind of let my remote viewing drop because it takes so much practice, and you have to stay with it. And I just did not have the time to devote to it. I would make the analogy of that's why I would not join a health club and spend thousands of dollars to become a member of a health club, because I don't have either the willpower or the time to continue to go to the gym and work out every day as you probably should.
Boy, tell me about it. I'm there with you.
You understand that, right, George?
I do indeed. Tell me this. Now, these SciSpies, these guys that can project their consciousness through time and space, they can see events, they can see places. Can they see into people's minds, read intentions, figure out, are you a good guy, are you a bad guy? Why are you doing this? What are you in it for? That kind of stuff.
That's a good question. I would say kind of yes, but that's no more than what we do on a daily basis. When we come up and meet somebody new, you know, you usually have a first impression. And sometimes first impressions can be wrong, but then more often they turn out to be correct. So we as humans can kind of intuit whether this is somebody I want to trust, this is somebody I'm not sure I want to trust, I'll hold off my giving them my trust, or, man, I can tell right away, I don't want to trust this person. So, you know, in that realm, and maybe to a little bit of an extent more, because they are trained and they have attuned their psychic intuition, that, yes, I think they can kind of intuit whether people that they go look at are trying to do something good or bad or in between, but it is not a black and white thing. It's not like they can just come and immediately say that this is a bad guy or this is a good guy.
Tell me this. One other question on the SciSpy stuff that's related in your newest book. Is there anything in this, different from Alien Agenda and the stuff you explored to the remote viewing there, that disturbs you personally, that really stands out, shocked you, scared you, disturbed you?
I'd have to say, no, not really. There were some things that kind of amazed me. There was, like you said, there were some dark visions, people living in dome cities, people living underground. But you have to understand, or at least this is what I understand, okay? Everybody's going to have their own belief. But it comes back to, how does remote viewing work in the first place? And this is the reason we haven't heard even more about it. Of course, the main reason is because the government found out that everybody they could test had the ability to use this psychic ability to go out and look at persons, places, things with their own mind. And they, of course, wanted to use this to spy on enemies and maybe even to spy on us. And they certainly don't want the average guy to be able to spy on them and find out for sure what they're doing. So they've kind of tried to discredit the whole thing, act like it really wasn't doing much good. But another reason why they haven't promoted remote viewing anymore than they have is that it violates the scientific method, which is you have a hypothesis and then you test it, and if you can replicate it over and over again, then it's no longer a hypothesis. It becomes a law, or it becomes established fact. Well, they have proven scientifically that a remote viewing works. They just haven't come up with the hypothesis on how does it work. But I'll tell you what I've figured out is that Einstein may have been onto it when he spoke about his unified field theory, which is that the entire universe is nothing but a mass of energy. At some point, and this could be debated on how this was accomplished, some of this energy coalesced into physical form, creating matter. And once matter came into being, then it came under certain natural physical laws. But the bottom line is, all matter and all energy is all part of the one huge energy field or grid. And so when we have a thought, just like in our computers, that thought is a spark of energy. Your computer monitor and your keyboard and your mainframe, you know, that really doesn't do anything. It's all those little bitty bytes of electromagnetic energy that collectively allows your computer to compute and even build up into artificial intelligence and get to thinking at a certain level. Well, same thing with us. We're all bits of the whole, but collectively it creates a mass sentient mind.
I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to move on to other topics, going to a whole laundry list of stuff. Area 51, Bob Lazar, Serpo, cattle mutilations, whole bunch of stuff. So stick around, everybody. We're talking with Jim Mars on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. This morning, Coast to Coast AM, the show, is sort of conspiracy central. We're talking with Jim Mars, celebrated author, and after this short break, we're going to come back and go down a laundry list of conspiracy matters, including the JFK assassination, the Serpo matter, Area 51, Bob Lazar, and as many as we can get in, including one of the most mysterious, mind-boggling, baffling parts of this whole thing, and that's the animal mutilation mystery. Jim Mars has written about it, knows a lot about it. When we come back, we'll ask him about it. Stick around on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're speaking with Jim Mars, and we've got a lot of ground still to cover. Jim, let's start with this one. The prospect of government UFOs, either ones that we're flying that they made or ones that we're flying that we made to look like what they're flying around. What do you think about them? Do we have them or not?
Sure. Yeah, we have them and probably have for some time.
You think
actually, you can go back to World War II. And when Patton's Third Army swept through southern Germany and scooped up the V-1, V-2 rockets, the Messerschmitt 262, the first jet fighter, they also found on the drawing boards flying saucers. And that's historic fact. The only argument has been, did they ever actually get some to fly? And there is some fairly persuasive evidence that, yes, they may have. But nobody knows that for sure. It's all been kept under wraps. And it's the secrecy of this whole thing that really bothers me. You know, philosophically, I'm not necessarily opposed to globalization, to the fact that we're all one world. Of course we are, one humanity. One of these days, George, somebody's going to ask you where you're from, and you're going to say, I'm from Earth. Okay? But we are being dragged into this globalization through deceit and secrecy. And people who are very powerful and want to hang on to the monopolies over medicine and energy and fuel, communications, they're trying to set up their own little globalization that they can run while the rest of us just work. And that's what I'm opposed to.
You had spoken earlier, before we took a break before, about the new information you received about the United Nations, about some sort of meeting that was held at the UN to discuss the possibility of disclosure. You know, we've both been in the field a long time. We've both heard these kinds of rumors before. Is this one any different?
Yes, I think this one may be different because it follows a pattern, and some of this information is coming at me from more than just one source. And as a newsman yourself, you know, when two or three different sources are telling you the same thing, that pretty well constitutes a story. Doesn't necessarily prove that it's true, but it proves that there's something going on there. And as I said earlier, this particular topic is not being, it's not like the governments have decided they're going to come clean. It's whoever's visiting here is making themselves seen more and more and more. It's becoming more and more unambiguous. And apparently the decision's been made that it's time that we start leveling with the public and start preparing them for a whole new world paradigm.
Well, it just seems like you'd have to drag some of them kicking and screaming into it, because what I've been told is a lot of people could go to jail over this, with the lies that they've told, the money
exactly.
They've stolen.
Exactly. And, of course, I wrote an Alien Agenda that my idea on why they have imposed this secrecy really has not so much to do with UFOs and their occupants. The New World Order people, they don't really care if we know there's aliens out there. But what they care about is if we know for sure there's aliens out there, and then we know for sure that there's alternative technology. And that might upset their monopolies over fuel and pharmaceuticals and telecommunications. So that's why they've been trying to sit on it. But it's cracking, as you well know, George. I mean, just, you know, say over the past 10 years, we are so farther ahead on this whole thing, and more people are aware of it. More whistleblowers have come forward than probably any time in the past 60 years.
Let me hit you at this one, and I recognize that this is not a topic that we could talk in just a couple of minutes, so you just have to give it the quick brush over, assuming
okay.
You have an opinion on it, but it's what's called chemtrails. Now, I see these things in the sky every day. I must get 20 emails a week from people who swear that it's some kind of a plot. You know, I looked into it a couple of years ago. I can't find any evidence for it. I know I've heard the stories that they're spraying this for nefarious purposes or poisoning us or trying to protect us. What's your take on that?
Well, I've studied pretty thoroughly, and it goes back to the late 90s. And how do I make this quick? They're real. Just as Dennis Kucinich said, that, you know, he added that into his bill to try to prohibit certain type of weapons such as mind control, nuclear armaments in space, and he listed chemtrails. The West German government just came out recently and acknowledged that they are involved in a spraying program. I'm an award-winning aviation aerospace writer. I know what a contrail is. That's a condensation trail. And even though they can hang in the air, depending on weather conditions, for a considerable amount of time, this horizon-to-horizon trail that then spreads out, does not dissipate, does not evaporate, spreads into a hazy film over our head. Plus, there's been plenty of tests made. They know that involved in this chemical spraying is aluminum oxide, barium, and that goes back to many years ago when Dr. Edward Teller said that he proposed that the solution to protecting our ozone and closing the ozone layers would be to put particles of heavy metal into the upper atmosphere, which would help plug the ozone holes. Of course, the problem is when you put heavy metals in the air, you're also affecting people's health. And I think that at some time, someplace, somebody made the decision that we think this might be a good thing. We need to protect the earth, but we need to keep it secret, because if people knew the health hazards of breathing this type of material, then there'd be a big outcry and they wouldn't let us do it. Again, it's the secrecy involved. If they can prove to us that this is safe and that it's something that's desirable and everybody says, okay, you know, the majority said that's fine, let's do that, I wouldn't kick. But they're still denying that it's happening, and yet it obviously is happening.
So you don't buy the stories about population or depopulation spraying us with chemicals to kill us?
No, not really. Mainly because spraying pathogens or something into the air is totally inefficient. If they want to kill us, there's plenty of other ways to do it, and it would be a whole lot quicker and a whole lot cleaner and probably a whole lot easier than trying to spray the whole upper atmosphere.
Yeah, plus I would think it would kill some of them and their families and things.
Exactly.
Like that.
You can't do anything about that. But the question, though, is would they do something like that? Yes, they would. There's instances in our past where they've released chemicals or sprays, biochemical
diseases.
Weapons,
yeah.
You know, off the coast of California and in the subways in New York. I mean, yeah, they'll do it if they think they can get away with it. So far, they've gotten away with it.
What do you make of the Serpo story? And for our listeners, it's sort of a story that's been making the rounds the last year or so about that there was an exchange program. Us, you know, the end of Close Encounters, the movie.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounded like somebody had seen Close Encounters, where we swapped some of their people for some of our people. George, I've looked at that and looked at that and looked at that, and right now it's in my Huff file. You know, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
I certainly think that there's a very compelling evidence that we may have had some sort of contact way back there, maybe missed back as far as the 50s. But when I get to this idea that we swap people, they came back, but nobody wants to talk, some of them decided they'd stay there, and some of the photographs, which are a little bit ambiguous, I'm not saying it's real, I'm not saying it's not. I'm just saying that's in my file.
Yeah, mine too. Mutilations. This is not in my huh file. This
no, that's
is
not
in my
huh file. That's very is, real.
You know, a friend of mine, Colm Kelleher, who's my co-author on a book we wrote, had written a book called Brain Trust, and he looks at, you know, he studied when he was with NIDS, he studied these cattle mutilation cases, went all over the country and looked at them and collected scientific evidence. He's convinced that there may be two monitoring programs, somebody like the aliens that Linda Howe has so documented so well over the years.
Right.
And then somebody else following behind them, maybe using this as camouflage for what they're doing to perhaps monitor contamination of the food chain. What do you think?
Well, that's pretty much the conclusion I've come to. And I started covering cattle mutilations as a newspaper reporter here in Texas back in the 70s, and it became pretty clear to me then, and I'm still pretty clear on this, that yeah, there are two factions involved there, because every time there are a series of cattle mutilations, you have reports of UFOs, but you also have reports of black helicopters, strange lights, trucks, official looking trucks that can go through roadblocks unhindered, all kinds of things. So it appears that either the UFOs are committing the cattle mutilations, and the best guess on that is because cattle have a very nearly the same chromosome match as humans. And so, plus, you know, you've heard the old adage that you are what you eat. And since most of us eat beef, eat McDonald's burgers and stuff, that's a mean, you know, let's face it, if they left mutilated humans lying around the countryside, there would be panic, outrage, a huge hue and cry. But when there's a few dead cows left lying around, and nobody but us most determined investigators really cares about that. And yet by taking the soft tissue from these animals, they can probably get a pretty good idea on how advanced pollution is, how it's affecting us. And as I said, it's a whole lot better for everybody that they grab a few cows rather than taking people.
Well, it's always been weird to figure out why they leave the cows behind anyway.
I mean, I know. That's kind of strange, too. I mean, if they're going to take them off, why drop them back? Beats me. But then, so it's either the aliens doing the cattle mutilations, which seems to be the case because there's some very strange attributes to these. I know, like a rancher told me out in New Mexico, he said, I've been ranching for 35 years, and he said, you can't tell me that a coyote can pull a cow's heart out through a small hole in its throat. So there's definitely some weird aspects. And then you got the blacked-out helicopters, the other group, which is probably the shadow government, the covert government operations, and they're chasing them, following them, tracking them, and trying to keep tabs on them and perhaps figure out, you know, exactly what they're doing. But there's a new wrinkle, George, and I don't know if you've heard about this, but this is disturbing to me. The cat mutilations.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard about those.
I have some friends that live down near Granbury, which is south of Fort Worth here in Texas, and they had a rash of these cat mutilations. And what I'm talking about is people will find half a cat, okay? And they can't find the hindquarters or they can't find the front quarters. And these people were in a community where they had a rash of these cat mutilations. In Georgia, it is a gated community, which means there's limited access and egress, which means, you know, you couldn't have just anybody and everybody rolling in there and killing the neighborhood cats and then rolling out of there. So this is a strange new wrinkle, and I'm not sure what to say about that, other than one of the theories is that they're sending a message probably to the government or the military saying, you know, you can't stop us. We can go anywhere and do anything.
You know, Linda Howe had written about that, I think, 5 or 6 years ago. There was an outbreak, a brief outbreak of that in Denver somewhere. So
right.
Somewhere in Colorado.
Oh, it's happened at various places all across the country. And that's another thing, George. Some of your listeners may be under the impression because the media is so controlled and they don't get to hear about this on any kind of regular basis that these cattle mutilations, animal mutilations, that, well, that happened some years ago, but it's not happening now. No, it is happening now. It's still continuing.
Well, you know, you will have to wonder about the fear factor. I think I've heard Jacques Vallée talk about this, is that by leaving the bodies behind, by these gruesome mutilations, cutting a cat in half, that freaks people out. And
exactly.
I don't know what the aim is, but it certainly leaves an impression.
Well, you know, I tend to think that they're going back maybe into the 40s. If you go back and study your UFO history, you say you just finished Alien Agenda, so you'll know what I'm talking about. Early on, when it became clear to the military that this was something real, they actually issued orders for military units to shoot down UFOs. You know, if you see them, shoot them. And that really didn't last very long because, I forget the exact year, but about 1952, 53, somewhere in there, there was suddenly an incredible increase in the number of air crashes. I mean, planes seemed like they were just dropping out of the sky. And I don't know when or if or how some communication was made, but the military then stepped back, issued orders that they were not to shoot at UFOs. They were simply to try to track them and figure out what they were and where they were going. And right after that, this increase in air crashes stopped. So perhaps the cat mutilations is something else has come up. Maybe we've gone back to shooting at them or and somewhere interfering with them, and they are sending a message saying, look, you know, if we can drop into gated communities and other communities all across the country and leave a mutilated cat behind, you know, we could do this to people too, so cease and desist whatever it is you're doing.
You know, we didn't have a time to get into JFK too much, but, of course, that was the first book I ever read by you, Crossfire. It still bothers me, and all the grief that, you know, Oliver Stone took over that movie.
Right.
And all the grief that you have probably taken over the years because
oh, yeah.
for the simple reason that people say, well, it's too darn many theories. It's the Mafia, it's the CIA, it's LBJ, it's the Cubans. Make up your mind. But for all of that, I mean, as you said, I don't know anybody who believes that Oswald acted alone. Not
no.
a person.
No, and here's the two things to remember always about the Kennedy assassination because they have – there's never been a cover-up in the classic sense of the word that you couldn't get information. The cover-up in this case has been obfuscation. They've thrown so much stuff out there and muddied the water so much that the average person just says, oh, man, I'm tired of hearing about that back and forth claim and counterclaim. But here's two things to absolutely remember about the Kennedy assassination. Number one, one person could not do the shooting, period. They've tried and tried. They've even had some TV programs trying to say, oh, well, we've shown that this could be done, but actually it can't. The FBI said the rifle that supposedly was used, 6.5 Mannlicher Carcano, they verified, and I verified this too. It takes 2 seconds just to cock the bolt and pull the trigger. And the shooting sequence, based on the Zapruder film, clearly shows that the shooting sequence took place within 6 seconds, 5.8 to be exact. Okay, so that's a 2/10 of a second under
the best time.
Best time you can do, just cranking the bolt and pulling the trigger, and that leaves no time for any kind of aiming. Okay, and then the next thing you always have to remember is they're still talking about how Kennedy, the magic bullet. Okay, yeah. The single bullet went through Kennedy's neck and struck Connally and caused all the wounds to Connally, and then ended up in his left thigh. Kennedy was never shot through the neck, period. End of story. The autopsy clearly shows the holes in his shirt and his jacket clearly show The witnesses clearly state he was shot at the level of the third thoracic vertebra, which is below your shoulder blade. So if he was shot below the shoulder blade in the back, how could the bullet, without hitting anything, course upwards and then exit out his throat? And if it did, then it would be going in an upward trajectory, and it would be physically impossible to hit Connelly. Okay? And, of course, they've come out with all these convoluted theories. Oh, his jacket rode up. Oh, he was waving. Oh, he bent over. You know, and none of this is correct. The correct point is that the autopsy doctors tried to probe this back wound, and it didn't probe. It didn't go through his body. So he got hit in the back, and the bullet never came out anywhere.
I remember that scene in the movie, that the tracing the track. Was it back and to the left, the Kevin Costner scene with that?
That's the trajectory, yeah, and everybody can see that for themselves in the Zapruder film, which is, and this is sheer physics. This is for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. If you're hit in the front of the head with a baseball bat, your head does not fly forward. Your head flies backwards.
Jim
and,
Mars?
If he was struck from behind by a high-powered bullet, then his head would have immediately been thrust forward. But that's not the case. It's backwards to the left.
We got to take a break. We're going to open up the phone lines. When we come back, stick around at Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're talking about wheels in the sky and things that go bump in the night and all sorts of conspiracies with best-selling author Jim Mars, author of Alien Agenda, author of Crossfire, Psi Spies, and a whole bunch more. Jim, while we're waiting for calls to start in, I wanted to, before we leave the JFK thing, just want to tell you that one of the things that always stuck in my head, and it's in the movie, too, is the scene where this woman is driving in a car and she's thrown out on the side of the road. And I remember from your book, Crossfire, that she was a real person. There was a real witness who said, I was going to Dallas with these two guys. They said it was our mission to kill JFK, or they had something to do with the assassination plot. And she told this to police a couple days before JFK was killed, right?
Yes, her name was Rose Sheremy. She also had worked for Jack Ruby, which ties him into the whole thing. And you're absolutely right. The House Select Committee on Assassinations actually did a whole little appendix on this woman, and they went and interviewed everybody at the hospitals there in Louisiana, the police, state police officials, and everybody involved. And she was trying to warn people that Kennedy was going to be killed in Dallas several days before it happened. Same thing, I interviewed a lawyer who had been in Jack Ruby's club and who saw a young man come in and sit in a booth with Jack Ruby several weeks before the assassination. And he was over there representing one of Ruby's clients, and he overheard the conversation, and it was, Lee, what are you doing back in town? I thought you were in New Orleans. And they went on and on about an assassination plot. And this attorney actually filed a report prior to the assassination placing Oswald and Ruby together. Talking about this conversation after the assassination, and they showed pictures of Lee Oswald, who had been in New Orleans, and he said that's the fellow that was talking to Jack Ruby. So we could spend a whole program talking about the instances of people who put Oswald and Ruby together. General Walker, Edwin Walker, once even told me that. And as Walker said, they're going to have to start all over just on the basis of the fact that Ruby and Oswald knew each other prior to the assassination.
We could also spend a whole program on all the people who died, all the people who were witnesses to one part of it or another who died, some of them from natural causes or supposedly natural causes, but a lot of them from causes that decidedly were not natural.
That's true. One important witness named Morrill was a biker, and they found him outside of Dallas with his motorcycle standing up on the kickstand, and he's lying beside it with his neck broken, and they ruled it a motorcycle accident. Picture this. He skids over. He breaks his neck. He gets up. He puts the motorcycle up on his kickstand, then he lays down and dies. Give me a break.
This is a personal interest sort of about Jack Ruby, but his Las Vegas connections. I've looked into some of those in the past, and Jack Ruby did have some. Did you come across any of those that you recall?
Oh, yes. Yes, very definitely. In fact, one of the there was a very well-known, wealthy man in Fort Worth who owned the newspaper there, and he made frequent trips to Las Vegas, and he had hired a woman to be his daycare sitter for his young children. That was Marguerite Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald's mother. And just about 2 weeks or 3 weeks prior to the assassination, this man made a trip to Las Vegas, came back, and would not even talk to Marguerite Oswald, simply left her a note that said, "Your services are no longer required." And 2 weeks later, her son's charged with killing the president. There were a lot of people that knew what was going to go on.
Essentially, you believe that Oswald thought he was working for the government as an agent or something like that. Our government.
Well, that's what his mother always told me. She said, "My son is employed by the government." And, of course, again, we could spend a whole program talking about all of the connections between Lee Oswald and the government. I think the only thing to say there is that a very prominent and distinguished military historian, John Newman, has published a book called Oswald and the CIA. And in there, based on internal CIA message traffic, only made public after the Oliver Stone movie, he conclusively shows that the CIA was using Lee Harvey Oswald operationally prior to the assassination. And one of these days, the truth will come out, and we'll find that Osama bin Laden was being used by the CIA prior to 9/11.
We'll have you back on the show for that, a whole show for that. But have you heard of this guy in Canada who says he's JFK's love child, is asking for, in the pages of Canadian newspapers, asking for Kennedy DNA?
Who does he claim his mother is?
That I don't know. I'm sorry, I don't know that one.
I don't either. That's, you know, there's... Again, keep in mind that the name of the game is obfuscation, okay? You just throw so many theories and so many things like this out there that it just confuses the issue to the point to where hardly anybody wants to deal with it.
Are you familiar with Vincent Bugliosi's book on the assassination?
Oh, yes, yes. I just had to put that one down quickly because I got a Charlie horse in my arm. It's 1,700 pages. He should have changed the title. It should have been entitled Reclaiming the Warren Commission. George, just forget it, okay? It's nothing but the same old prosecutorial brief against Oswald with no consideration being given to the massive amount of information that could show his innocence or show that he was, as he himself said, was set up to be the patsy in the assassination. Bugliosi even devotes 2.5 pages to a made-up conversation between some imaginary mafia guy named Vito and Jack Ruby, which, you know, it, by his own admission, never took place. You know, how's that advance the case?
Okay, we're going to come back, take a short break, come back and take some viewer listener calls. So stick around. Jim Marsh, hanging in there?
I'm hanging.
All right, we'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. We have some time left with Jim Marsh, best-selling author, and we're going to go to the phones now. First to our East of the Rockies line, Jimmy in Brooklyn. What's on your mind?
Hi. JFK, President Kennedy, was constantly warning Martin Luther King about his communist advisors around him, and then JFK gets killed by a communist. Now, I know a lot of people don't want to believe that, but there's a common denominator between Martin Luther King and Lee Harvey Oswald. One of them is Carl Braden, who's the head of the Department of Agitation and Propaganda, because Lee Harvey Oswald was one of the heads of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and that's a communist-controlled group, and Martin Luther King attended the Highlander Folk School. Both of these groups had contact with Carl Braden, who was the head of the Department of Agitation and Propaganda.
Whoa, the Department of Agitation and Propaganda, where's that at?
That's for the U.S. Communist Party, Carl Braden. And he also got, Carl Braden got convicted in 1956, I believe it was, for blowing up a black home in Louisville, Kentucky. The Communist Party also trained Sam Bowers, the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, who was made famous because of the movie Mississippi Burning. The goal was to stir up race trouble in America, to discredit America in the eyes of Africa as the Soviets were making their moves on Africa.
Hey, Jimmy, do you have a question? Do you have a question for the guest?
Well, I just think the guest is helping promote the idea of world government and some of the stances he's taken, pushing the idea of global warming when that's already being debunked, because the people who are pushing global warming want global solutions, which means global government and global control, and I think that's pretty dangerous.
Okay. Jim?
Well, I think the caller needs to do a little bit more digging. He'll find out that Oswald himself said he was not a communist, he was a Marxist, and he was carefully schooled because he was trained to infiltrate communist activities. His activities in New Orleans was to try to draw out pro-Castro communists. He was working for the government. The whole thing was an early COINTELPRO, and I've never said there's no global warming, okay? But, by the way, just for the caller's benefit and for everybody's listening, the problem's not with your SUV. The problem is solar system-wide warming. The polar caps on Mars are melting. The outer planets are becoming more iridescent because they're heating up. The sun is erratic. This is something that whatever's going on, it's impacting the entire solar system, not just the Earth.
And I guess maybe, you know, if you want to debate whether humans are causing global warming on Earth, you could say that at worst or at best, we're not helping anything with it.
Well, obviously we have some problems with pollution and environmental degradation. But I'm not saying that we should just keep rollicking merrily along and partying and destroying the Earth, but the caller is right about the fact that this thing about global warming, and it's all because we're driving cars, that's just being used as a control mechanism. And
okay. All right. We're going to go to our first-time caller list, Carl in Ann Arbor, Michigan. What are you doing?
Good show, guys. Mr. Mars, I've just got a couple of comments, and then I have a question for you. First of all, I think the whole key to this thing, if anybody knows anything about high-powered rifles and scopes, there's two words that'll prove to everybody that Oswald couldn't have done this by himself. The two words are moving target.
Absolutely.
Oswald was a sharpshooter with stationary targets in the Marines, not moving targets. That's how they train.
Wait, and let me interject quickly they classified him as a marksman, which is the lowest of the three grades. It's marksman and then sharpshooter and then expert. And
exactly.
When he was about to get out of the Marines, he only qualified as marksman, the lowest grade, by only 2 points. So he was a mediocre to poor shot.
Exactly. And me being involved with the SWAT team here in the Michigan area, I can tell you, when you shoot a high-powered rifle, you have to acquire your picture through a scope. And that's on a stationary target. After the rifle discharges, the recoil will throw your eyes off the target. You then have to reacquire. You have to rack the gun with a bolt-action rifle, then reacquire a sight picture for the second shot. On a moving target, it's nearly impossible to do within that time frame. He could not have done it. And the question I have for you is this.
Well, wait, let me ask you one thing, because you say you're a sniper with a SWAT team?
With a .308 rifle, exactly.
Okay, then I'm sure that you're aware of plunging fire, which means if you fire from a high position to a lower position, gravity has to be taken into consideration because your bullet will drop lower, a little bit lower than where you're actually aiming. So you have to compensate not only for your windage, but also for this plunging fire. Isn't that correct?
Exactly. That's exactly right. But the bigger issue is a moving target.
That's the big one.
Now, he probably had the rifle rack for the first shot, so he didn't have to. He already had the sight picture acquired. But when he had to rack the rifle for the second shot, he lost his sight picture. He would have to reacquire a sight picture for the second shot through the scope on a moving target.
Right.
That is nearly impossible. It's not even considering the adrenaline that's going through him at the time because he is shooting at the President of the United States.
Right.
It's impossible for him to make those three shots. The two key words are moving target. And the question I have for you is why haven't more experts in scope rifle firepower come out and discuss this issue?
Well, they have, but they get short shift in the corporate-controlled media, which does not allow that information to be widely disseminated.
Thanks, Carl. That was excellent. We're going to go to our wild card line, Jeff in Chelsea. Jeff, are you there?
Yes. Very, very simple. I think that the UFO phenomenon, for the most part, is our military technology or some other technology, and I will preface it with two books. One is called Black Helicopters by Jim Keith, which Jim Keith believes in the same thing, that for the most part, the UFOs is just advanced military technology, and also a book called America at the Brink by Thomas Bearden, who is a lieutenant colonel in the Army, who talks about Russian scalar technology and the effect of Russian scalar technology can mimic UFOs.
Okay. Actually, I'm very well aware of Jim Keith and his material, the late Jim Keith, and I think that largely I agree with him. I've already said early in the program that I think many of the sightings we're having today are probably secret government test craft. The question, though, is where did they get that technology? And my question to you is, if it's all military, secret military test craft, how do you explain these massive UFO sightings prior to the Wright brothers flying?
Well, in the case of America, and I know where you're coming from, but after World War II, you had Operation Paperclip, and there is a 10% wiggle room to which is debatable. Because
wait a minute, what do you mean by wiggle room? We're talking about 1896 and 1897 when the newspapers were filled with stories of this balloon, cigar-shaped object flying at fantastic speeds across the countryside.
Well, demonic activity.
Demons. Okay.
That's the 10%, which is you do have about 10 to 15% wiggle room, and there is such a thing as demonic activity, which is described in the Bible. So you do have that 15%, but I still think that for the most part, most of it is our technology, and it's from Operation Paperclip. When we brought over the Nazi scientists after World War II, we took ours, the Russians took theirs, and Nikolai Tesla had technology way beyond his time, around the 1900s.
Well, there's a good deal of truth in what you're saying.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff, for that call. You know, I think we can all agree. I mean, most of the people in ufology who've been studying this stuff for a long time, they'll say, you know, you can accept that 90 to 95% of everything that is reported as a UFO can be explained in prosaic terms. I mean, that's a given. Then you add in the fact that there's probably are all kinds of secret aircraft. I know here in Nevada, we have Area 51. It has always been the testing location of choice for advanced weaponry and aircraft, the SR-71, the U-2 and the SR-71 and Have Blue and F-117, all kinds of things like that. So there are advanced aircraft. They do fly around, but that doesn't explain a lot of sightings, as you mentioned, Jim, earlier, not even as far back as 1897, but in the 40s and 50s,
right.
Aircraft doing things that we simply can't do even today.
But, George, speaking of Area 51, how are they coming along with the Aurora?
Well, I wish I knew. I mean, I keep asking them to let me in out there, and they're just not going along with that.
And my follow-up question is, why in the world did they name it the Aurora, which just happens to be the name of the Texas town where something crashed in 1897 and all the reports of the airship stopped?
That's true. That's right. It's a coincidence. You think it's related?
Yes, I think it is. Because just like the Apollo missions early on, it was clearly connected to the Orion and to the Osiris Egyptology or Egyptian mythology. And yeah, there's something going on. There are people within the agencies and the groups that are pushing all this that have a vast understanding and knowledge of human history.
You've seen the statements made by Ben Rich, the late Ben Rich of Lockheed, who's talked about advanced aircraft and the technology that we have, and we have the ability to go to the stars, but it'll never be let out. Do you buy that? Do you believe that he was accurately quoted?
Yes, I think that's pretty accurate. That goes back to what I said earlier in the program, in that the controllers, the wealthy elite who are hoping to control this planet and certainly trying, they really don't care if we know there's other worlds out there. They just do not want to give up their monopolies over energy and pharmaceuticals and telecommunications and transportation.
Jim Mars, hang on. We've got a lot of callers waiting to talk to you, and we'll be right back with more of Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. We're in the home stretch with Jim Mars. We could probably fill another couple of hours with all the folks we got holding on the phone. So we're talking about all sorts of conspiracies, including the mother of all conspiracies, the JFK assassination, the story that won't go away, the story that the world public, the American public in particular, won't buy. One of the things we're going to ask Jim Mars about when we come back is about the three tramps. You've all seen that photo of the three guys who were dressed kind of weird and picked up on the streets of Dallas, and one of those guys is suspected of being involved in the murder, but also is believed to be the famous, the father of a famous actor. And when we come back, we're going to get into that. We're taking a short break. We'll be right back with Jim Mars on Coast to Coast AM. Jim, we're talking about the JFK assassination, and I just mentioned in the tease leading up to this, to the issue of the three tramps. Do you believe that those three guys were picked up wearing kind of odd shoes for their circumstances, were involved in the assassination, and do you believe that one of them was, in fact, Charles Harrelson, the father of actor Woody Harrelson?
Well, I cover that in my book, Crossfire. In fact, I have a whole little section called The Role of Hitman Harrelson. The reason you can call him the hitman is because he is a convicted assassin.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Okay, and at the time, the tall tramp was estimated to be between 25 and 30 years old, and in 1963, Charles Harrelson would have been 25. It fits right in there. There have been photographic analysis done that shows, based on a wrinkle that goes around his neck, the size of his ear, shape of his ear, and other facial features, there's very compelling evidence that Charles Harrelson may have been one of the so-called three tramps that were pulled off a boxcar trying to leave the area and then marched back through Dealey Plaza some short time after the Kennedy assassination. But now there's also this intriguing story that it was a Dallas News story where a reporter from the Dallas News tried to interview Harrelson when he was in jail, and he said, I can't talk to you now, he said, because they're bugging my cell. And a few months later, sure enough, it came out that the authorities were indeed had a microphone in his cell. But he told this reporter, he said, so I can't talk now, he said, but when I get out of here and I'm free to talk, he said, I'll give you the biggest story you ever got. And the reporter said, well, what is it? And he said, well, I can't talk, he said, but you just remember this. November the 22nd, 1963.
Well, that's a pretty big hint. And, of course, I have a Las Vegas connection to that, of course, because Charles Harrelson was hired by a guy named Jimmy Shagra, a Texan who was a Las Vegas high roller who got into trouble for smuggling drugs and had Harrelson, allegedly, had Harrelson assassinated.
Well, he was convicted of it. Wasn't allegedly. He killed Judge Wood.
Yeah, he killed Judge Woods. The alleged part is that whether or not Shagra hired him to do it. Yeah.
Yes, okay.
Anyway, there was an ulterior motive for me bringing that up. But we're going to go to our West of the Rockies line, John in Palm Springs, who I think has some sort of a connection to Lee Harvey Oswald. John, you there?
Yeah, I appreciate you taking my call because I have something to add. I was born and raised in New Orleans. I was in that Civil Air Patrol squadron at the New Orleans Lakefront Airport, the same one that Oswald came out of. Mm-hmm. And that was about a year or so before me and my guys. But Oswald and me and my guys were both under the senior command as cadets of David Ferry. David Ferry was the senior commander of that squadron, Civil Air Patrol, when we were in there.
Right. By the way, let me point out that David Ferry was the character played by Joe Pesci in the movie JFK.
Terribly portrayed, because he wasn't that flighty and nervous. He could have knocked you down if you, if you cornered him.
And he's a very brilliant man, wasn't he?
Oh, I know that very well. He was a master hypnotist. I knew him personally, and also I can connect him and Jack Ruby, and my buddy and I took the drill team before the deed was done in Dallas, but, you know, the very beginning of the 60s, into Dallas, and a phone number was pressed into this senior, now senior cadet, that went along with us, and it was Jack Ruby's phone number. Dave said, here, if you, while y'all are in Dallas, if you need anything, here's a phone number. It was Jack Ruby's phone number.
Right.
Holy cow. Because
he, wrote, cause he ran the one of the only after-hours clubs.
Oh, I know it well.
Dallas.
The cellar.
Yeah.
The, you know, we talk about a topless place. That was also a bottomless place after a certain hour at night, because when we lived in Dallas in 67, we used to go over there.
Right.
But also, I've held in my hand a picture out of a bivouac that has Oswald and Ferry in it at the same time. And Oswald's biography in the computers skipped from high school to Marines. We had a couple of Marines training us in hand-to-hand and warfare when we went north of the lake under Dave's command. There's no other squadron in the whole world that would have two Marines training kid, you know, high school age kids.
Right.
Although in the movie was portrayed, I'm sure the adult, you know, the adult, you know, mercenaries and such. But the cadet age, me and my guys were taken maybe on the weekends. But,
well, then you know that fits in very, very tightly. Let me run this by you and get your take on this. Marguerite Oswald, Lee's mother, once told me that when he was in junior high school, he showed up after school one day with a military officer. And the military officer told his mother, Marguerite Oswald, said, Lee is a bright boy. He's a self-starter. He, you know, he can operate independently. He's the very type of guy we need. And they were basically kind of hustling him to go into the service, even in junior high school. Does that sound correct to you?
Yeah, and that service might have been the Civil Air Patrol. I think that was a culture dish for Dave. Dave also, you know, as I said, a master hypnotist, and then the missile sites in Cuba were on his wall in his apartment, and before the rest of the world was privy to it, plus the Jack Ruby connection and the picture that I'm trying to get back from the widow.
Wait a minute. If he had pictures of the Cuban missile sites prior to the missile crisis in the fall of 1962, he could have only gotten that through government intelligence, right?
Well, yeah. I don't know factually. I cannot say factually, but you know, speculatively, you know, there's double agents and then there's triple agents.
Right.
If you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
And I would like to get a hold of you sometime. I don't know if you came out here into Palm Springs where I'm years ago on the radio show, but I went to that thing. If you were one of those guys, you know, I have these things to add to this thing, and it's time that it gets out.
Hey, contact me through my website, jimmars.com.
Yeah.
And by the way, while I'm at it, let me put in another plug for Jim Mars Forum on the AboveTopSecret.com. If you want to get into many different forums, many different threads, many different conspiracies with people who know what they're talking about and are not just up there flaming back and forth, AboveTopSecret.com is the place to go.
Yeah, those are good guys. John, thank you very much for that very interesting call, and you guys are going to have to hook up, and I sure hope you keep me in the loop. Thanks very much for that one. We're going to go to our wild card line, Robert in Rhode Island. What's on your mind this morning?
Good evening, gentlemen. Hey, real quick questions. First, where is the best place to get the resources for training on that remote viewing outside of joining the military? Second, what's your read, Mr. Mars, on William Cooper's assessment that it was the limo driver of Kennedy's that got the final shot in and was helped with naval intelligence?
Right.
And thirdly, real quick, have you come up with any information that might prove that the possibility that Reagan somehow started to contract Alzheimer's after his UN address in which he acknowledged the possibility of UFO.
Well, there's a mouthful. Thank you,
Robert.
Oh,
boy. There's another whole program. Let me back into that. First off, about Reagan, yes, I've heard that. I think it is true that, in fact, actually it's true that they didn't announce that he had, make public that he had Alzheimer's until he was out of office. But he there is some evidence that he was having some problems even before he left office. Then number two is to the
driver.
That's just hogwash. sorry, folks, that did not happen, okay? And I don't mean to impugn the dead here, but Bill Cooper was, I contacted him myself personally, and so did many others, and we told him and tried to explain to him and show him. In fact, the first researcher, Lars Hansen, who first came up with that theory, later, after he looked at all the evidence and saw the improved Zapruder film frame by frame, he realized that that was not the case, and so he repudiated. He said, no, that didn't happen. Unfortunately, William Cooper just kept pushing that thing until his death, I suppose. And so, it's created a lot of confusion out there. It did not happen, period, okay? End of story. Now, as to where you go to get remote viewing training, that's a really good question. And that's going to have to be a highly individualistic effort. I would say go on the Internet and look up any number of these former military remote viewers who offer various styles and various means of doing the remote viewing, but be very careful because there's a lot of people out there who claim to be remote viewers or who claim to give remote viewing lessons, and they may or may not be qualified to do that. I know when I first was introduced to the SciSpies and got to working with them, I told them right then, I said, fellas, I can see what's going to happen. Once the story of remote viewing gets out to the public, where once you had Madam Han palm reading, now you're going to have Madam Han remote viewer. And, George, that's kind of happened, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. And you got some that are good, and I guess some that are not very good at it.
That's right. So I think the best thing I could tell your audience is to try to search out one of the people that was involved in the U.S. government's military remote viewing program. Many of those are teaching courses, and then you just, pick the one that you think would suit your style.
Hey, along those lines, Jim, there's a guy named Ed Dames who's very famous and very much connected to that topic, and somebody had asked me to ask you this question. He's been on this show a lot of times. It seems like every time I've heard him, the end of the world is coming.
I kind of declined to get into personalities.
Sure.
But in this case, you have a fellow who told us that Martians were hibernating under the desert of New Mexico, and told a national publication in early 95 that in the summer of 95 they were going to surface and make contact. And he made the statement that if this doesn't happen, I'm getting out of this whole business. And of course, neither happened. And of course, that's the same fellow who tells us that something was coming along following the Hale-Bopp comet that was full of pathogens and that we were all going to be dead within 6 or 8 months, and that didn't happen either. So, again, buyer beware.
Okay. We're going to go to our wild card line. David in Palmdale has a question. What's on your mind this morning, David?
Hi there. Actually, Palmdale, California, Plant 42, Skunk Works, all that good stuff. We see nice stuff flying out here all the time.
Oh, yeah. You don't 44. Work there.
What's that?
You don't work there, do you?
No. It's not. Here's that brings me into my question. I have a lot of friends who do. In fact, a good friend who's been there a long time, and he's one of those that he can't talk about his job. But the people I know are working in there. It's something's going down. They're getting stressed. He was in tears today, saying, "I wish I could tell you. I just want to be a burger flipper." I mean, Jim, what do you think's going on? There's something going on in that facet of the government.
Right.
Where these guys are getting stressed, and I feel as if he's one of the guys holding it together, helping to actually hold it together.
Well, of course, I don't have any special insight, so I can only speculate like you can, but I think that this may fall under what I mentioned earlier in the program about the fact that the decision has been made for us that we're going to have to start coming clean and coming out with more serious and credible UFO information because of all of the increased sightings all around the world. And these guys who've operated there at Area 51 with pretty much total secrecy over all these years, the fact that this is going to start coming out and that they may have to redouble their efforts, they have to figure out a way to stop them or at least detect them, you could see where that would put additional stress on them in that work situation.
Okay, thanks for the call. We're going to go east of the Rockies. Walt has a JFK question, I believe. Good morning.
Good morning. How you doing tonight?
Okay. Howdy.
My question for Mr. Mars is, since I had a 6.5 Italian carbine, I wanted to know if he observed that when you fire a round in that, when you hit the bolt handle to extract the round, it also cocks the bolt, which adds a lot of extra pressure to it. So when you hit that handle to bring it up to extract the round and cock it at the same time, you really got to smack that handle.
That I do have one of those carbines, and you're absolutely right.
Okay, good. Cause
it is not a smooth operating weapon. In fact, are you aware that I know you know that it's an Italian war rifle. It was made during World War II by the Italians, and the Italians nicknamed that Mannlicher Carcano the humane weapon because it was notoriously inaccurate. And
all
not
right.
only that, but even if you go look deep in the Warren Commission, you'll find that they had to put three metal shims, and they very thoughtfully gave us showed us a picture of the three metal shims that they had to put under the telescopic sight of Oswald's rifle to make it accurate enough to test.
Wow. Thanks, Walt.
The stuff you've never been told.
Appreciate that, Wald. We're going to go to our wild card line. John in Long Island, what's on your mind?
Hello, George. Hello, Jim.
Howdy.
I just want to comment on the UFO hunters. It just seems that they're actually using old cases. Why don't they travel, take their expensive equipment to Mexico City, which literally there's sightings every day there, and then try to analyze
whole flights of them, right?
Excuse me?
I said whole flights of UFOs seen down in Mexico City.
Oh, that's the hot spot of the whole world for UFOs. I can't believe they're not there.
Right. Well, oh, boy. This gets into the corporate control media who will only allow certain things, and you can only investigate up to a certain point. George Knapp and I have, you know, we've been in the middle of this for years. You can talk about some things, but you can't talk about others. You can talk about some things, but you can only talk about them to a certain point. And I assure you that when you go back and you find out that the same five media corporations own everything you see and hear, including those cable channels, including the networks, including newspapers, magazines, billboards, it's amazing we're getting any information out at all.
Thanks, John. I appreciate it. Jim, we got a minute or so left, maybe 2 minutes. I'd like to know, are you an optimistic guy? I mean,
yeah.
Considering the dark stuff that you deal with and the conspiracies, you're optimistic?
Yeah, pretty much. That's why, you know, you find a disproportionate number of drunks and people with alcohol problems and drug problems among lawyers, doctors, police officers, because they deal with the reality of life, and reporters also. But
yeah,
but I've always kind of taken an optimistic look, and also you have to take a look at the humorous side of things. You know, folks, everything may seem like it's gloom and doom, and it probably is, but it's a big joke. You know, we're all gonna this life is not the end all. You're going to keep going. You're going to go do something else. And the other thing is that I am optimistic. I really think that within most of our lifetimes, we're going to see a truly kinder and gentler United States, or world anyway.